Well, hopefully you've gotten some rest from the past week, and we're going to resume our study in the book of Acts. There's, I think, three copies of our current lesson back on the back counter, so if you need one, there hopefully are a couple in the back. It's Acts 17 is where we left off at, and so just give a brief reminder to you of what we talked about last time, kind of what's going on, if you remember. So if you'll go to the first page of that study, we are presently in Paul's second missionary journey. So there's three that are going to be recorded through this book of Acts. The first one, if you look on the map there, went from Antioch, which is on the very right side in the yellow where Syria is at. And that's where it started, the first and second one rather. And it went to Cyprus, and then it went into Galatia, and then it came back around to Cyprus and back to Galatia, or back to Antioch. And so kind of stayed in a smaller circle. This time he broadened his circle a little bit, or has been broadening his circle a little bit of where he's going. He went back to the same locations as before, strengthening the brothers. It's there that Paul and Silas are joined by the young man Timothy. And if you remember in Acts 16, we had the whole experience where he's waiting on what to do. He determines maybe I should go to Asia, maybe I should go to Bithynia. And then he's like, no, I don't think so. The Lord's forbidden me from going. The Holy Spirit has. So he goes to Troas, which is on the northwest corner of Asia. If you'll look there, there's a little town called Troas, just barely in the pink still. And he has that Macedonian call where he has this vision. A man from Macedonia is saying, please come and help us. And so it's there he goes to Philippi. He meets Lydia, as well as he meets the Philippian jailer. And we kind of leave Acts 16, come into Acts 17, where he goes through Amphipolis and Apollonia. And then in the first 9 verses of this chapter, we were in Thessalonica. And so we spent a considerable amount of time not only looking at this text, but then also we turned to the book of 1 Thessalonians, and we kind of compared the two. So we took the first 2 chapters of 1 Thessalonians, and we just took the first 9 verses of Acts 17, and we kind of laid them over on each other in some way. And we looked at what are the information that we're learning and where's the crossover. And I think we saw a lot of crossover, a lot of things that we got informed about that we didn't know if we read Acts 17, that we learn about the Thessalonians when we're reading 1 Thessalonians. And then we learned a lot about what's going on in Acts 17 by reading the first 2 chapters of 1 Thessalonians. And so that was the most of our study this last time. And so page 2 and 3 of your outline, 2, 3, and 4 actually, are all about making Bible study connections. And we really emphasize to you that that's the way that you learn as you go through. And the next place we're going to get to is Corinth in the very next chapter, chapter 18. And obviously there's 2 full books dedicated to Corinthians. And so you'll see Paul's allusions to when he first met them and all the different people that were there. And if you go over and read 1 and 2 Corinthians, it's all there. The same things that he records in Acts 18. There's a lot of crossover there. And so that's kind of where we started. And then we went into page number 5 on your outline. And it has the next 5 or 6 verses of Acts 17, verses 10 through 15. And we learn about Berea. And it tells us that they were more noble than those of Thessalonica because they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily, whether these things were so. And so also, we want to make note that in both of these occasions, Paul went into the synagogue first. So he's targeting the Jews first. And that's a pretty unique response from the Bereans. Everywhere else he's been up to this point on the first journey, on the second journey, there's been a group of them that believe, and then a large group that rejects it and stirs up trouble for him to the point that he's getting beaten and he's getting hurt. And this is the first place where it basically tells us that universally the whole group listened intently. So with all readiness of mind, they gave consideration. That's a pretty notable thing, because I bet if we went to any Jewish synagogue today and started asserting that Jesus was the Messiah, I have doubts that they would say, tell us more. Right? That's what they did here. And so that's why the scriptures really esteem the Bereans very highly, is because of their initial response to that. And they even took it a step further than just receiving the word with eagerness. It says that they went daily and search the scriptures themselves to see whether those things were true or not, which is obviously an ideal response to the gospel. You don't want to just believe somebody because they're eloquent in speech or because they have a very good way of expressing or perhaps because their argument is very convincing. But they reference the Old Testament scriptures, which was all they had at the time, and tried to come and nail down those conclusions. Now, those in Thessalonica, some Jews that had caused problems in Thessalonica, heard that Paul was in Berea. And so they left Thessalonica, they come to Berea, and it says they heard Paul was there. So again, we tried to say last time, it gives me the impression by the way that Acts is dealing with this, that Paul is the primary vocal teacher. Because he's the only one that's run out of town. Silas and Timothy are allowed to stay. And we told you at the very end of this that the Bereans cared so much about Paul's well-being that they escorted him to Athens, which again, if you go back to page one, real quickly, if you see in the top left-hand corner where Berea is at, excuse me, then you'll see that Paul had to take a boat to get to the next location. So if you look on the top left-hand corner, it says Thessalonica, and then just west of there is Berea. So from Berea, if you go follow that red marker line all the way down to Athens, is where that they went. And so Paul had to take a boat to get there likely, unless he went into that inland part. And the Bereans wanted to accompany him, make sure that he was safe on the way there. And so that's where we left off, is that, and then he sends word back, rather, with the people that escorted him, and he said, now when you get back, tell Silas and Timothy to come to me hurriedly. So he's just in Athens, he's waiting on his companions to join him, and that's where we pick up verses 16 through verses 34, and all this time he is going to be in Athens. Now it's worth noting that Athens was considered both at this time and just generally for a large period of history prior to this, a central place of learning. So this is where the philosophers, this is where, you know, the Harvards, the Oxford, that's Athens. It's considered the place where the highly educated are at. Highly wealthy people are in Athens. And so this is not some small city, some small town. This isn't an uneducated place. And this is not a predominantly Jewish place. Right, we're now in the heart of Greece. And the heart of polytheism abounds. It's everywhere. Right? So remember, we would say the further you get from Jerusalem, likely, A, the less they've heard about Jesus. That's for certain. Because all this Jesus movement is very new. And so the further we get away, the more Paul is having to tell them who Jesus is. And remember in the last lesson we told you that he was spending a lot of his time at first saying the Messiah is going to come, suffer, die, and be raised again. So he doesn't talk about Jesus. He's talking about the figure of the Messiah. And he's trying to convince them the figure of the Messiah is not going to come as an earthly king, but as a humble atoning sacrifice. And he's going to rise again. And then after he has shown them that, then he gets to saying, now let me tell you about Jesus, who did the very things that the Messiah was prophesied to be. So I think it's a safe assumption with the Bereans, that's probably what they're looking into. You said the Messiah is going to die? We've never heard that. You say he's going to die and then rise again? That he's going to be a fulfillment of all the feasts and he's going to be a fulfillment of all the types and shadows of the sacrifices? Prove it, because that is completely antithetical to what we've learned in the past. Now, even Jews today, you would have to convince them of that very thing. Because the Jews, even today, if you know an Orthodox Jew, they think that there's going to be a leader that's going to rise up in Israel and that he is going to conquer all the enemies. He's going to be this from the line of David and be an earthly king. And so he's now coming, and we're going to really switch gears here. Because now we're kind of stepping away from the, I'm appealing primarily to Jews, to now a whole different group of people. Now, we're going to see, still in Athens, the first place he goes, and so I think Megan and maybe some others are keeping track for us, he goes to the Jewish synagogue in Athens. So he still starts there, and that's where we're going to pick up in Acts 17, and then it's going to go from there. So I don't know if I'm going to, I may stop along the way and point some things out instead of just reading it all, because there is a whole lot here, and I'm not going to get to a lot of it, because there's a lot here. So this is Acts 17, verses 16 through verse 34. It says, "Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons." Now when I looked that up, it said God-fearing Gentiles. So it seems like he's making a distinction of people who still worshipped the Jewish God. I read that to be somebody like Cornelius, right, from Acts 10, because that's some of the words that it uses to describe Cornelius. And so a God-fearing Gentiles is who I looked that up to be. And it says, "And in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and the Stoics encountered him, and some said, 'What will this babbler say?' Others some, 'He seemed to be a setter forth of strange God, because he had preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection.' And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, 'May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know therefore what these things mean.'" Okay, so we're going to pause there for just a minute. And then in the parentheses, it says, "For all the Athenians and strangers," which just means foreigners, "which were there, spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing." And so you can see here the progression of what Paul's doing in Athens. He begins, he goes to the Jewish synagogue just like he always did in every single city. Once he got done with them, likely there were Gentiles that were ascribing to the Jewish customs and religion and God. He starts teaching them and preaching to them. Then he goes to the marketplace, and I'm not going to get into the history of the Athens market, but it was a sprawling event where people would come once, sometimes twice a week. It was a humongous gathering, and it was a big marketplace, and there they would come, and he would begin to talk with people in the marketplace. I think it's a safe assumption based on the text and based on the way that Grecian culture worked that it's in that place that these men of very high learning that had specific sects of philosophy that they ascribed to, the Epicureans and the Stoics, they encounter Paul. Now, right away, you're going to hear Paul and you're going to know he's an educated man. Some scholars assume we know that he knew a lot of different languages. He obviously had been schooled from Gamaliel, who was a philosopher, became a world-renowned philosopher. So he was schooled not only in all the way of the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish philosophy, but then even beyond that, he was schooled in all the different philosophies. We're going to find that in his sermon here. People are going to pay notice. Now, I want to make a comment about that for just a moment. That when the Lord is with you and when you know the truth and you begin to speak it, you don't need to decorate it with all these, with eloquence, with some way to get people intrigued. The truth just has a way of piercing through everything else and getting people's attention. And I think sometimes people are looking for the trick to evangelism or the trick to get people interested, or having had just the minister school, preachers are looking for a way to decorate their preaching with a way that people will be more attentive. And I think Paul here reveals that when you deeply know the truth and you can express it in a versatile way, whether I'm speaking to Jews and I'm delving into the Old Testament, whether I'm speaking to Epicureans and Stoics who have all their highfalutin philosophy, no matter what, notice the message hasn't changed. He's preaching about Jesus. He's preaching about the resurrection. And these Epicureans and Stoics are very intrigued by what he's saying. And so they invite him to come with them so that he might propose this, what they called new doctrine, to the people that were at the most esteemed place in all of Athens called the Areopagus. That was a place that people came, and oftentimes political decisions were made there. Sometimes, obviously, it tells us in the text that philosophical discussions at great length would come and play there. People from all over the world would travel to Athens to go to this Areopagus, which was a lifted up hill. Now, it was said by the Grecians, I think it was, that one of the sons of Poseidon was killed on this hill, and that's why it became such a famous place where all this discussion took place. And so he comes there, and they say, we've never heard, this is a new doctrine. They call him a babbler. Right? They say that it's something strange, but we want to know more about what he has to say about this God that came to earth. He resurrected. His name's Jesus. Come to the Areopagus and tell us. So I don't even know how to make a comparison today about the opportunity, but this is the opportunity of opportunities for Paul, in the sense of being able to speak to the elite intellectuals of his day. Over in Oxford in England, there's a lot of times they'll invite world-renowned scholars to come to Oxford, and they give like a 45-minute speech. And then Oxford students or faculty are able to be there, and they're able to come up to the lectern and basically question what the person says. That's probably the best comparison, because that's the most esteemed college that does something like that. They've done it for hundreds of years, and this is the kind of opportunity that Paul is getting here at Mars Hill with these people. So anybody have a comment about this opportunity, a question you want to make about Athens, the Areopagus, the people who he's speaking to? Have a comment or a thought about any of this? Now, this next section, I want to slow down. I'm sorry, does somebody have something?
I was just going to say, this is the first city that, as you said, was so large that there was a lot of different beliefs, idolatry, and everything else that we see. Paul, he starts out with the synagogue, as he always has, but his perspective of how he approaches the other groups is uniquely different than any other city that he's gone to up until this time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is, in some ways, this is just a whole, I would think of it like if we were in the Bible Belt, a place if you wouldn't have big influence would be a church. Maybe a big First Baptist Church of Atlanta or First Baptist Church of Austin, Texas, or whatever, some big place. If you go to New York City, it's probably Madison Square Garden, right? And that's kind of the comparison. There's just two vastly different crowds, the things you're going to do. And so we're going to notice in Paul's sermon here some things. But I want to point out, as we're going through the beginning of this sermon, there are some ways the King James, I think, translates it that unintentionally misrepresents his audience and his tone. And I want to point this out because it's a theme that we've hit on really even when we were in the book of John. We talked about this some. So in verse 22 is when Paul begins to speak. He says, "Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, 'You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious.'" Now, if you read that, it sounds like an insult, right? You're too superstitious. That's not really what he said. He said, "I perceive in all things that you are very religious." That's a vastly different approach to the people, right? Because if one's an accusation, the other man's is an acknowledgement of similarity. He's about to put forward religious ideas. And so he's trying to connect with these people. I'm noticing in all this that you're a very religious people. Right? And that's, again, relating to what he's about to do. Now, it continues, says, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions." Again, that just supports that idea. You're very devoted, and the devotions are meant in the actions, right? All the things that you're doing are very religious, and you're devoted to these practices. And so he's building a bridge, and that's what I'm trying to say, to connect to the people, not a wall to divide the people. He says, "I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship.'" Now again, This is where, and we won't get into it tonight, but this is where syntax is like the arrangement of a sentence, how a sentence is ordered the words, right? So when you're translating from one language to another, the translators in other languages, they don't speak the way we do, right? So they're not putting subjects and verbs in the same ways, and their syntax is not the same. So the choice that they make here is they say that they're ignorantly worshiping. And I don't think that's really what he's saying. He said, the unknown God who you are worshiping in ignorance is who I'm going to talk to you about today. So that word, and I think the way it has it in the King James, it's almost like that's an insult. You are ignorantly worshiping him versus you are worshiping him in ignorance. You just don't know about him. And you've acknowledged that. That's why you put the unknown God as his subscription or inscription there. And so I wanted to point that out because I think those three recognitions change the tone of how he is speaking. He's saying you're very religious. You have all these devotions. But I want to talk to you about the one that you've confessed and acknowledged you're worshiping in ignorance about. Because you've titled him the unknown God. That's very different than him coming and saying, you're too superstitious and you're ignorantly worshiping this God. Right? So I want to really emphasize that because that really falls in line with the way Jesus and Peter through John and Acts has done. When Jesus was speaking to Samaritans, whenever he was speaking to people who were desirous to know the truth, he didn't go and get up and call them ignorant. He built bridges to them, right? Now, when he went to people who were hardened, lawyers that were trying to catch him, he called them for what they were. Peter does the same through the book of Acts. Paul here is following that same pattern. Here are people who have said, invited him. Come to the most esteemed place you can and speak about this unknown or this Jesus that you're talking about his resurrection. The first thing Paul is not going to do is get up and say, you're too superstitious worshiping somebody, you ignorant people. He's not going to do that, right? And so I think a re-rendering of that text is probably more accurate to fit the tone. And then it also fits the rest of what Paul is going to talk about. He doesn't insult the people throughout the whole thing. He's trying to draw the people in. He's trying to make connections with them. And so he says, so that's how he sets up. Whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. Verse 24. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Now again, I don't think we can possibly conceive of he is differentiating himself and his religion versus everything that is around them. Remember, it said when he got to Athens, his spirit was stirred within him. Why? Because he saw the idolatry rampant everywhere. He saw all of these Greek gods, all these people, and I don't mean this as an insult. If you've ever been in a Catholic church, especially out of the country, they have all these little figures and idols, and a lot of times you can pay money right there and you pray to it. Right? Put that on steroids. That's what's all throughout Athens. It's everywhere. And so he is trying to completely change their conception of who God is. God is not somebody that's served in a temple with these stone images. But he says, God made the world and everything in it. He's outside of us. He's outside of our little creation. That's the God he's trying to speak of. Neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, saying he giveth to all life and breath and all things. Again, he's getting right to the heart of the differences. These Greek believe, or these Greek polytheists. If you study any of, I'm not going to take the time to get in all. They just had it all backwards, right? There is just such a misunderstanding about who God was and what He needed, and Paul is just completely turning that all upside down. And then he's saying that it is the God that he is speaking to them, that he is not dependent upon us as though he needed something. He giveth to all life and breath and all things. We're completely dependent upon him, which again to the Greek mindset is just foreign to them. And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. And hath determined the times before appointed and the bound of their habitation. Now that's, if I had to pick, top 10 verses in the Bible, this is probably one of them right here. Because what Paul is appealing to here is providence. Okay? So, and I think this is something that, doctrinally, we obviously need to believe this, but its effect directly upon our faith in the midst of troubling world events, this is a really crucial set of verses, right? Because here in a few months, the world, especially in our culture, we're going to get really uptight about an election coming up. And we're going to see two people, two parties, vastly different visions, and certainly God's blessed us to live in a republic that we do, to use your vote the way that, God would want you to. I'm not dismissing all of that. There's a place to study and to look at all that as it looks through Scripture. But that's a far cry from panic. That when things go wrong and the people who win aren't the people you think God wanted to win, you're wrong. Okay? Because the Scripture begins to reveal quite a bit to us about the providence of God and then the purpose behind God's providence. And I think that's the really heart of what Paul is getting at, is he's going to teach us this abstract truth about God's providence, and then he's going to immediately follow after and say, the reason for this is for this. And there are two things that people often, sometimes in our minds, Satan wants to disconnect these things. When Paul is clearly saying these things are directly connected. Okay, so if you look at verse 26, he first points out something that all nations are derived from the blood of one man, Adam. And that for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed for those people, for those nations. So this is teaching us that God has in his providence a plan for the length of a nation's life. He has determined the time of their rule. He has appointed that. Now, we could get all off into predestination and how those things work. Can man's activity shorten or prolong that? I think the Scriptures would teach us yes. Do I think there's examples in the Bible where that happens? Where in Nineveh's time, God was going to destroy Nineveh, and then they repented, and so God prolonged their judgment some 50 or 60 years down the road. That's whenever they were judged, and they ended up being wiped out. So can man's activity play a role in that? Yes. But that does not take away from the point that God has determined the length of a nation's life. That's in his hands. So rather than fear and allow fearmongers to speak into us that every year it's the most pressing election in your lifetime. Every 4 years, that's the way it is. This is the most important thing. And if we're going to lose our republic, and especially the advent of social media, it's preying on people. It's fear-mongering on people. And they're just sitting there waiting for the November election, just terrified. And then when it comes, you better be prepping, because it's the end of the world and Armageddon has come because Joe Biden got elected or Donald Trump got elected. This is telling us that all of those things God has determined. It's okay. God knows who's going to win in November. And if God chooses to end the United States of America in November, I don't know that an election is going to really change that. Do you? The God of the cosmos has determined it's the end of America's reign, and you think that our piddly election of one person is going to really alter that? No. God has determined the bounds of, or the times before appointed, and then it also tells us this, and the bounds or the boundaries of their habitation. What land do we live on? Now, this would have been especially relevant to a Greek culture who had just been dominated and conquered by Romans. And obviously, during that time of conquering or of conquest, that was of especial interest to these people because for thousands of years, it was just one conquest after another, And it was going to last for quite some time after this. But he is giving them this reassurance that God is not this distant being that's just leaving people and nations to their own ways. But God is highly involved, both on an individual level in our lives, but what he's brought out is even on a national level. God has determined the times before appointed and the boundaries of our habitation. The United States has, and I think the more you study the United States, it's a prime example of God having blessed us with the exact boundaries that we have, including Alaska and Hawaii, both of which have become instrumental places that we needed at really important periods of time. God allowed that, right? And all the 48 too. And so he says God's involved with that. That's very different from a Greek polytheistic mindset who has all of these gods and they have, they're just sinful just like you and I. They have lustful passions just like you and I. They're corrupted. They murder one another and they cheat on one another and they do all these things. This is a God that is completely foreign to them. I want to pause for a moment and see if you have anything you want to add to this. Comment you want to make.
It seems like Paul's being very proactive in building an argument. Mm-hmm. He's definitely not accusatory. And he's taking what he knows about the Greek culture and using it as a building block to his final arguments.
Absolutely. And I think that is a necessary thing for the people that we witness to, is that if you've ever seen evangelism take place where it's like one person is trying to impose on, I'll call them the victim, like their way of life and their way of thinking, and it's really the evangelist-centered, you need to believe this and here's why and do this, and Paul's not really doing that. Paul is purposely stepping into their world and in their world finding a way to reveal the God of the Bible, which is a necessary pattern for us to learn from. Somebody else have a comment or a thought? Now here is his bridge, and it's just a brilliant bridge, not only as a method, which I'm less concerned about, but also as a profound truth. So the way the world, and especially our culture, is that we have this, you know, American culture, and within our American culture, we have this little compartment called religion, and you can do what you want to in religion, and we have economic box, and you have a whatever box. But it's compartmentalized, and religion and the purposes of God are just this small thing. And actually what Paul tells us is something quite profound. That God makes his decisions about the rising and falling of nations, and God determines the allotment of boundaries for this reason. So it's not all these grandiose political reasons. It's not all of these, you know, for kings and for culture, all these things that people can claim. But it says, here's the reason why God providentially arranges the world powers. Look at verse 27. That they should seek the Lord. That's a pretty big claim. So when we look through all the unfolding events of history, So you take events in your own lifetime that have been huge events in our nation. Take 9/11. Take any number of events that have occurred where things in our culture, things in our politics, the world changed drastically. And very often people are trying to, you know, why did God let this happen? Why did God allow this person to do this and this? Well, here he tells us that one thing that God is trying to come to the end of. Now, can God be yielding judgment? Absolutely. But even in that judgment, God is using his judgment upon a nation to do what? To reveal to the world that they need to seek God because judgment is coming. And so every event in world history where large things are taking place and the world is changing and the map is changing and we think, you know, this is just bigger than religion. Is it though? Or does God know? And what is he revealing here is that always in the intent of God are the souls of men. God cares very little for who owns what property, what armies win a particular battle, only in so much that it relates to the souls of men. Because he knows one day this whole world's going to burn, all the things in it. Who really cares about the stuff? We do. God doesn't in the slightest. What God is angling for as he allows these things, as he pronounces judgment, as he rescues and protects certain nations from being conquered, is he's looking that people might seek the Lord. And to me, this is the most clear example where he takes a macro perspective. He zooms out to 30,000 feet. And he says, all of these grand things happen so that people will seek the Lord. So you can ask the question, why did the Holocaust occur? And there are a lot of sub-reasons why it happened that are relevant for us to study and consider. I can't help but believe that it has to do with the souls of men. That God would not allow 6 million people to be systematically executed the way they were and it just have nothing to do with eternity. Very much the opposite. God's always got that in view. And if you look at World War I, World War II, especially in Europe, the map changed significantly. And every time, there was a reason, not only in the immediate, but also down the line. Right? Who know? Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to get into that. Somebody have a comment or a question about that you want to make? Now,
I think it would be appropriate to say when, you know, the question always gets asked or it gets said, like, everything happens for a reason. Like, if that's true, this is the reason. Do you think everything?
So I would say, that's a lot to unpack in that comment. Because the word everything, right? Because this is when we get into God's permissive will and everything. I'm not going to say what I believe this, but I will say this. There is a belief that suggests that God's permitting things to happen or causing things to happen, the things that he permits and the things that he causes are all meant to lead to the optimum number of people being saved in the end. Okay, so that would mean, if that is true, then I would say yes to that comment. I don't know if I agree with that or not. Right? But that is an important question because, especially if we're talking at a, obviously at a micro level, there's a lot of emotions, but at a macro level, it's the implications of everything. That's a big deal. To say everything is ultimately meant to lead people to the Lord. I would tend to lean to the answer yes. That people would. Now that's often, we are often going to forever remain naive to how one thing could possibly lead to people seeking the Lord. But I think the argument could be made that yes, that is the case.
You've also got to remember Mm-hmm. Who is going to turn to him and do his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he is uniquely equipped
to
kind of the judgments, if that's exactly what he
means. To the everything. He's the only one. And even us in hindsight, we can't do that. And so could you come up with a scenario where I'm like, I have no idea how it's going to cause people to do. Yes, you could to me. Could you do that to the Lord? No, you couldn't. Because he does know each person uniquely. And to me, I think that's what he gets to in Pharaoh when he hardens Pharaoh's heart. Is that God is doing things to Pharaoh, knowing that Pharaoh was going to reject him anyway, to cause certain events to happen both then, and I would even say now, thousands of years later. And so, yes, I think verse 27 deserves to be weighted very heavily in the way that we see the world and the unfolding events of the world. That God has determined. Now, specifically as Paul is speaking, I don't think we could include everything. I think what he is the macro level, the way nations unfold, God is involved. So you're kind of stepping outside the boundaries of the text, but I think I would, to some degree, lean that direction, yes. Somebody else have a comment or a question about that? And I'll note that that's relevant because, I mean, just a couple weeks ago, I was listening to a debate between a Christian and an atheist. And that's what the atheist did. He said, please explain to me how some child in the Sahara Desert, starving to death with no newspaper coverage whatsoever, just dies. How does that lead to XYZ with God? And so that is a relevant question to ask today, because it's what people who are mad at God or rejecting God, that's what they're going to run to. Tell me how these horrible things lead people to seeking the Lord. And somebody else have a comment or a thought? Now I want to also press in verse 27. This is language that we are accustomed to as missionary Baptists, and particularly at our church. We say these words a lot, but in larger, you know, within our American culture, these are not ways people describe people finding the Lord. Notice the words that you use, that they should seek the Lord. You don't really hear that a lot in religious culture in America. Go seek the Lord. What do you mean, go seek the Lord? Just go accept Him. Paul is saying here, no, you have to seek Him. If haply you might feel after Him. Again, religion today has removed a lot of the senses outside the mental, and we assent to those things doctrinally. That's how we get saved. We just agreed to it mentally. And he's saying, no, you have to seek out the Lord. And to me, it's suggestive. This whole description that he gives is people in darkness. Right? If this was completely dark in here, and you said, well, Brad, it's in the middle of the room. Okay, I know where the middle of the room's at, but there's a lot of obstacles and there's a lot of people. And remember, these people or these spiritual beings, these demons, are not static. They're not staying at their table. They're trying to put stumbling blocks in front of me. They're trying to direct me different ways. They're saying, hey, you're going the wrong way. You need to go that way, right? So what he's saying, and that's what's going on in Athens. They have all these Greek gods. They have this horrible sexual culture that is so, I mean, insanely perverted. Like, I always used to say to my kids when we get to certain cultures, if I really told you the history of this culture, it would be X-rated and I'd get fired. And all I would be doing is reading a textbook that was telling you the truth. Because, I mean, this stuff is heinous, the things that went on in Greece, Athens being one of the epicenters of this. And so imagine if you're saying, you know, there's real God and he's organizing this whole thing because he wants you to find him. But you're in darkness, so you need to seek after him. And so that's what you start doing, right? You start kind of, you're feeling your way. You're trying to, and then somebody's saying, no, go this way. And you're trying to do the best you can to seek and to feel after him. And it says, it keeps on going. It says, and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. And I think that's A great description for lost people to realize. Like that analogy that seems to be suggested in the text. It's not like I'm saying to you that are lost, God is in Austin, Texas. Good luck. You got to feel after Him and find Him. He's here. He's very near to you. And obviously I'm using this analogy, it's locational, but this is a spiritual thing that He's describing. God is not far from you. He is very close, but you're in darkness. And there are many demonic spiritual creatures. There's many physical people and things that are trying to deceive and stumbling blocks. And your own wicked heart is a problem. All these things. So you have to seek Him. And part of seeking is what Jesus taught us. You seek and you continue seeking. You ask and you keep on asking. You knock and you keep on knocking. And that's when Jesus says that in Matthew chapter 7. I hope you know already. That word, the ask, the seek, and the knock, in the Greek word, it's saying to continue doing. It's not saying you say, hey, Lord, will you save me? It's this perpetual. It's this, you're going to ask until you get an answer. Just like there may be some people in this room who you sought the Lord, and by God's good grace, you sought Him and you found your way the very first time and you got what you were looking for. And there's other people, you start in the same place, lost in your sins, with pride and a wicked heart, and instead of going that way first, for some reason, you go this way. And so you're having to find, and then you get yourself somewhere, and then these things start getting whispered in your head. You're never going to get saved. Why are you even seeking the Lord? God's not even real. Have you ever felt God talk to you? And then that consumes your mind for a while, right? And then all of a sudden you find a hobby you're interested in. And suddenly now your idle mind just, all you do is think about that hobby all the time. And so all these chances, you can still seek after the Lord, feel your way and find Him, but instead you're consumed with this other thing you're wanting to do. So I love the visual that He gives to these people that are actually in darkness. Seek after Him. Feel your way if happily you might find Him. And then He gives that wonderful encouragement that is so relevant to us to tell people, He is not far from you. Like, that's another thing. We're not talking about an object under a table that is just sitting there. We're talking about a being that is moving towards you. He wants to be found of you. And His voice is drawing you to Him, and He's being drawn to you. And so He says these things, and He begins to, again, just laud. Notice in this whole thing, He's giving a description of who God is. There's so much in here about the nature of God. For in Him we live and move and have our being. So in Paul in Colossians, He sustains us by the word of His power. That's the same type of thing that Paul's going to write later to different people struggling with something different, but it's the same, appealing to the same part of God's character. Everything about us hinges, and again, that should be a direct encouragement to your faith. Your heart will not stop beating until God says it's done. Period. He is sustaining nations. He is determining the boundaries of those nations. And then He jumps down into the micro and He says, you live, you move, you have your being because of Him. All things are dependent upon Him. And as a Christian, that is a rich foundation for practical faith. We don't run around like people who don't believe, scared all the time of death. We don't make every provision that something bad might not happen or some disease not happen to us. We know that God has securely protected and ordained the boundaries of our life. And if God decrees to extend it, we have scripture in the Bible where He does that with people. Right? Hezekiah. God told him you're going to die, and then God said, oh, nope, 15 more years is going to get added. All at the decree of God, not the change of circumstance. It's not that He went to one physician and God said, well, man, you got behind my back. I didn't see you there. You went to that cardiologist and he helped your heart, extended your life 15 more years. Wasn't that? right? God determined those things. And maybe sometimes people get really afraid because they say, you know what? I overlooked this health condition and now that's why I am where I am. Or God just didn't press the issue in your heart hard enough to where you go get it checked out. Right? Who knows? There's a lot to unpack, and I know there's some boundaries there on each side. But this is just clearly telling us, in Him we live, we move, we have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said. Now notice again, here's an appeal to connecting with them. Right? He doesn't quote the Bible. He doesn't say, my poets, my prophets. Some of your own poets have said, for we are also His offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's devices. So now he's getting at the heart of idolatry. And this is where, couched in this description, is an assault against the heart of their religion. But notice how he assaults their religion. It's not mean, but he just speaks the plain truth. And I think this is such a wonderful example from Paul, that notice he does not, at the onset of his sermon, just try to insult people. But when it comes point for him to heartily disagree and confront the error of their religion, he does it head on. He does not back away from it. And there is a place for that. I think our culture tries to tell us either attack people viciously or just don't bring it up. And here Paul balances perfectly. He's respectful. He's doing everything he can to build a bridge. But when it comes time to addressing the error of their religion, he does it head on. The God you serve is not the true God. He does not embody some gold, silver, or stone thing. And in verse 30, he even takes it a step further. In the times of this ignorance, God winked at, but now commandeth all men everywhere to repent. Because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, we will hear thee again on this matter. So to Paul departed from among them. So again, he gets into some big things, but also I think he addresses a point that people have a acute awareness of in our own hearts. I think there's just this awareness that we all have that one day we're going to be judged. I'm not even talking about Christians. Just all people. That's why there's a sense of morality in all nations. Is because there's just this, it's like karma, right? That's the whole concept of karma, kind of. Well, what you do will come back to you. Another word of saying, you're going to be judged in proportion to what you do, right? Muslim culture, it's no different. There's just this self-evident truth that says, you know, I just have a feeling the wrong I do, I'm not just going to get away with. There's going to be a day of reckoning coming. And that's where Paul leads these people. And I think here's a sympathetic way to express the truth to people that you're worried about their response. If they know that it's not even about hell per se, but if they know that your love and affection for them is because you truly believe one day we're all going to be judged by God. And that judgment, he says here, will be based upon one man that he rose from the dead. So a visual, I think somebody this week in the ministry school, I can't remember who it was, you know, he didn't reference this text, but kind of referenced this visual of imagine Jesus being that standard over here, and every human being being put next to Jesus. Your righteousness has to match his righteousness, or you don't get in. Or you're going to get punished for your misdeeds. That's kind of the visual he's setting up here. And you can disagree about the way I see God, the way that all these things Paul is saying, but certainly for a person that may not even agree with you, they can understand the compassion in a person that says, hey, I'm afraid one day you're going to be judged by God, and I want to make sure you're prepared for that day of judgment. Just like I need to be prepared. Everybody has to be prepared for that day of judgment. And it terrifies me that you would ignore that. And I think Paul identifies here a compelling reason why we all can't be silent. You know, like we can't just be silent about people standing before God in the judgment. I'd rather be ridiculed. I'd rather be looked at as somebody that's a zealot trying to push my religion on somebody. I'd rather all those judgments be the case than for my loved one to stand before God in judgment, having never heard that there was a day of judgment. And he is pointing that out here where he says he has appointed a day. Notice too in verse 31, he has appointed a day. So notice in the text, he has appointed a time, the nation's rule. He has appointed the boundaries where they rule. And now he has appointed a day of judgment. All of these things are particular decisions made by God. And the evidence that this judgment is going to happen is that he raised Jesus from the dead. The response, some mocked, others wanted to hear him again. And yet, verse 34, we left off. It said this, howbeit certain men clave unto him and believed, among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. So it seems like he's saying that a leader of Athens, an Areopagite, somebody who regularly was at that prestigious place, he was an intellectual likely, he believed Paul. Here we get another woman that I think we had talked about in the previous weeks. Someone who obviously had some fame to some degree that was a ruling woman or a well-known one. She also believed. And so we have really all three groups represented. And we've seen these three groups throughout the book of Acts. Outright rejectors, people who are unsure, people who believe and are saved. And all three of those are present in this. And to me, that's another thing that gives me hope, is that we've been in the extremely Jewish locations. We've seen all three groups of people. We've been in the Samaritan locations. We've seen all three groups of people. We've been in the Gentile locations. We've seen all three groups. We've been in blue-collar, poor prisons. We've seen the groups. Now we're at the elite of the elite, intellectually. We see all three groups. And I think that ought to give us hope and confidence. I've heard it said before. We should not determine beforehand who is worthy to hear the gospel based upon what we see. Well, they're a higher socioeconomic condition. They're really smart. They're a non-believer. I don't think they would receive it. Well, here in the book of Acts, we have all people of all different shades, all different kinds, and literally all different colors. And some are believing, some are uncertain. Some are not believing. And that ought to give us great hope when we go out. Right? Somebody have a comment or a thought about Paul on Mars Hill? Question you want to ask?
Good point. There's a lot more that didn't believe than did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Which is common among the intellectuals today. Absolutely. And a lot of it is the pride, obviously, you know, that has always been a... There's a lot of books, there's a number of books that I've read that have talked about why intellectual people tend not to be saved, right? And there's some common faults or flaws that fall into that. Somebody else have a comment or a thought? All right, so our next section that we'll jump into, obviously, is Acts chapter 18. And if you'll look on your very first page of that study, this is... Paul's next place after Athens is going to be Corinth. And we can see that we're going to start getting to some familiar names here. He's going to go to Corinth, and then he's going to hit Ephesus shortly after that, and then he's going to be back into the area where Christianity really took off. And so then that will complete his second missionary journey.